Dana has a right to sue, in writing, in a statute. The Franklin Fair Data Act says a data broker must format consumer files a certain way and lets any consumer whose file is mishandled recover $500. A broker misformats Dana's file. The violation is real, and the $500 is right there in the text. Dana walks into federal court and loses before anyone reaches the merits. Why? Because nobody ever saw the file. No lender, no landlord, no harm. A federal court is not allowed to hear you just because a statute says you may sue. This episode is about the locks on the federal courthouse door and about how you can be completely right on the law and never get through one. Here is the root. First, Article 3 and the four threshold questions every case must survive. Then, standing, the biggest by far, where most of your exam points live. Then, advisory opinions, ripeness, mootness, and the political question doctrine. Then, sovereign immunity. And finally, judicial review, and how far Congress controls what federal courts hear. Start with the source of the limit. Article 3 vests the judicial power of the United States in the Supreme Court and any lower courts Congress creates, then extends it only to cases and controversies. Two words carry the whole doctrine. They mean federal courts decide concrete adversarial disputes and nothing else. Justiciability names the rules policing that line. Sort those rules by the question each one asks, and you will never mix them up. Standing asks, who? Is this plaintiff entitled to sue? Ripeness and mootness ask, when? Has a real dispute arrived, and does it still exist? The advisory opinion bar asks whether there is a real dispute at all, and the political question doctrine asks which branch. All four are threshold issues. A court must clear them before touching the merits, and they can be raised at any time. The constitutional ones a court must raise itself, because they go to its very power to act, which is Dana's problem. She is right about the statute and never reaches it. Standing keeps the courts busy with people who have a real, personal stake. Notice where the emphasis sits. The plaintiff needs skin in the game, not the issue. Three constitutional elements, and every plaintiff must satisfy all three. Injury in fact, causation, redressability. Memorize that. It is among the most heavily tested rules in constitutional law. Injury in fact first. The invasion must be concrete, meaning real rather than abstract, and particularized, meaning yours rather than everyone's. It must be actual or imminent, not conjectural. Physical and financial harms are easy. Intangible harms count too, like disclosure of private information, but only if they closely resemble a traditionally recognized harm. And here is the modern rule that decides Dana's case. A bare violation of a statute is not automatically a concrete injury. Congress can create legal rights and elevate ignored harms into actionable ones. What it cannot do is hand standing to a plaintiff who was not actually hurt. No concrete harm, no standing. Change one fact, though. Send that file to a lender who denies her credit, and it is concrete. Two refinements. For damages, the risk of future harm is not concrete unless it materialized or caused a separate present harm. For an injunction, you need a real and immediate threat of future injury. Past harm alone will not do. Causation and redressability are two sides of one coin. The defendant's conduct must have caused the harm, and the court's order must be able to cure it. Both weaken in the same situation, when the real cause is a third party the court cannot control. If a favorable ruling leaves the plaintiff's world unchanged, redressability fails, which explains a whole category of losing lawsuits. Plaintiffs sue federal officials to force tougher enforcement against other people. The injury traces to third parties and to the executive's discretion. Redressability is speculative, and Article 2 gives the executive authority to set its own enforcement priorities. Next, generalized grievances. Because the injury must be particularized, you cannot sue merely as a concerned citizen, asserting that government should follow the law. A harm shared in substantially equal measure by everyone is a generalized grievance, and nobody has standing to litigate it. That is, the ballot box's job. The same logic bars taxpayer standing. There is one narrow, memorize-it exception from Flast versus Cohen. A federal taxpayer may challenge an expenditure only if two things are true. 1. The challenge attacks an exercise of Congress's taxing and spending power itself, an actual appropriation. 2. The claim is that the spending violates a specific constitutional limit on that power. Only the Establishment Clause has qualified. The court keeps that box shut tight. It does not reach discretionary spending by executive agencies, only congressional appropriations, and it does not reach tax credits, because a credit is not an expenditure. Municipal taxpayers, though, usually can challenge illegal spending by their own local government. Now, third-party standing. As a rule, you assert only your own rights. Courts relax that in limited situations, but notice the constant. The plaintiff must still satisfy all three elements with an injury of their own, and only then may they raise someone else's. A close relationship will do it, a doctor asserting patients' rights. So will an obstacle keeping the third party from suing. Two more routes. An organization may sue for its members on a three-part test. One member would have standing alone. The interests are germane to its purpose, and neither the claim nor the relief needs individual members to participate, which is why associations seek injunctions, not member-by-member damages. A First Amendment litigant may also attack an overbroad law chilling others' speech. Two cautions. An organization cannot conjure standing by spending money to oppose a policy it dislikes, because a self-inflicted litigation expense is not an injury. Ideological intensity never substitutes for concrete injury. On to timing, starting with the rule that shapes the others. Federal courts do not give legal advice. Two features must be present, or the court is being asked for a forbidden advisory opinion. An actual dispute between adverse parties with genuinely opposing interests, and a substantial likelihood the ruling will bind them and change something. One consequence candidates get wrong. Declaratory judgments are allowed. A binding ruling on the party's rights before anyone acts is not advisory, because the dispute is real and the ruling settles it. Rightness stops a suit that arrives too early. It shows up most often in pre-enforcement challenges, where a plaintiff attacks a law before it is enforced against them. Courts weigh two things: fitness of the issue for decision, where a purely legal question is more fit than one needing a factual record, and hardship to the plaintiff of withholding review. Test that. Columbia fines any licensed therapist $10,000 for an advertisement the state board later calls misleading. A therapist wants to run truthful ads now, and reasonably fears ruinous fines. Must she place the ad and get punished before she can sue? No. The question is fit for decision now, and her only options are violate the law or self-censor protected speech. Ripe. Say nobody ever threatened enforcement. Unripe. Mootness is ripeness's mirror image. It kills a case that arrives too late or dies along the way, because a live controversy must exist at every stage, from filing through final appeal. If the law is repealed, or the plaintiff gets everything asked for, the case is generally moot. But four exceptions keep a moot case alive. Capable of repetition yet evading review, where the harm is inherently too short-lived to litigate fully, like an election dispute, and the plaintiff can expect to face it again. Class actions, where a certified class survives the representative's mootness. Collateral consequences, where lingering legal effects remain. And voluntary cessation, the favorite trap. So slow down there. The defendant stops the challenged conduct but stays free to resume. The case is not moot unless the defendant carries the heavy burden of showing the conduct cannot reasonably be expected to recur. A city that repeals an ordinance only after being sued and could readily reenact it has mooted nothing. Even a perfect plaintiff with a live dispute can be turned away if the issue is a political question. That means it is committed by the Constitution to Congress or the President, or there are no judicially manageable standards. This is separation of powers, not partisan politics. Two signals dominate: a textual commitment to another branch and the absence of any legal yardstick. The classic non-justiciable examples: foreign affairs and recognition of foreign governments. The training and composition of the military. The Senate's procedures for trying an impeachment. And partisan gerrymandering. Now the caution. Courts routinely decide whether a branch exceeded its powers, and one person, one vote claims are justiciable. Different lock, same door. States entered the Union as sovereigns, and sovereigns cannot be sued without their consent. The 11th Amendment, ratified in 1795 to overturn an early decision letting a private citizen sue a state in federal court, protects that dignity. A private party generally cannot sue a state for damages in federal court. Two clarifications the exam demands. First, although the text speaks only of suits by citizens of another state, the court has long read it to bar suits by a state's own citizens too. Second, the immunity is bigger than the federal courthouse. Under Alden, it also bars private federal law damages suits against a state in its own courts. Who is protected? The state and its arms, so state agencies, state departments, and typically state universities. Who is not? Local governments. Counties and cities can be sued in federal court because they are not the sovereign state. Two plaintiffs also fall outside it: the United States suing a state, and one state suing another. Then the most tested workaround in the topic, Ex parte Young. A private party may sue a state officer in an official capacity for prospective relief. An injunction or a declaratory judgment to stop an ongoing or threatened violation of federal law. The fiction is that an officer, acting unconstitutionally, is stripped of state authority. Two limits define the escape hatch. The relief must be prospective. You can order an officer to stop violating federal law going forward, but not get retroactive damages from the state treasury. And it reaches federal law only. A federal court cannot order state officials to obey their own state's law. That is the Pennhurst limit. You may still sue an official in a personal capacity because that money never touches the treasury. Work it. The Olympia Department of Motor Vehicles enforces a rule that violates a federal statute, and Rosa wants to sue. She sues the department for damages in federal court. Barred or allowed? Barred. She sues the director in her official capacity for an injunction stopping enforcement going forward. That one fits Ex parte Young. She recasts it as a state regulation violation. Barred again, under Pennhurst. A state can also lose the immunity two ways: consent, which must be express and unequivocal, never implied, or abrogation by Congress, which works only under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, and only with unmistakably clear statutory language. Not Article 1 powers like the Commerce Clause. Last section. Since the founding era, federal courts have held the power of judicial review, that is, the authority to interpret the Constitution and refuse to enforce statutes, executive actions, and state laws that conflict with it. When two laws collide and one is the Constitution, the court follows the Constitution. It is the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. So, how much can Congress limit what those courts hear? For the lower federal courts, quite a lot. They exist only because Congress created them, and the greater power not to create a court includes the lesser power to withhold cases. The Supreme Court is different, and this split is exam gold. Its original jurisdiction, the cases it hears first, such as suits between states and cases affecting ambassadors, is fixed by Article 3, and Congress may neither enlarge nor shrink it. Its appellate jurisdiction exists with such exceptions as the Congress shall make, that is, the Exceptions Clause. Even so, that power has limits. Congress may not dictate the outcome, prescribing a rule of decision that tells a court what result to reach, without changing the underlying law. It may not command Article III courts to reopen final judgments. And it may not violate due process, the suspension clause, or anything else in the Constitution. One last limit, and it returns us to where we started. The Supreme Court will not review a state court judgment resting on an adequate and independent state ground. Adequate means the state ground by itself supports the result. Independent means it does not turn on a federal question. If both are true, a federal ruling changes nothing, so it would be advisory. A word on authorities. Next-gen questions put you in the lawyer's chair. Does the plaintiff have standing? What is the state's best argument? Can Congress remove this case from the federal courts? They never ask for case names. The four names here are memory pegs, and every rule behind them stands on its own. If you keep only three things, keep these. The three-part standing test, injury in fact, causation, redressability, recalled cold, because this topic is starred. The four mootness exceptions, because calling a case moot too quickly is the classic error. And the original jurisdiction rule, because Congress can carve at the appellate docket and cannot touch original jurisdiction. Now the traps, straight from the examiner's favorites. 1. Treating a statutory violation as automatic standing. No concrete harm, no standing. 2. Forgetting that the plaintiff needs standing, not the issue, and that even a third-party standing plaintiff needs their own injury. 3. Letting a plaintiff sue to force the government to enforce the law against someone else. 4. Calling a case moot too quickly and missing voluntary cessation or capable of repetition. 5. Thinking that suing in state court or naming a state officer for damages escapes sovereign immunity. It does not. 6. Allowing ex parte Young relief for state law violations, which Pennhurst forbids, or for retroactive damages. 7. Saying Congress can abrogate immunity under the Commerce Clause. Only Section 5 of the 14th Amendment works, and only with a clear statement. 8. Assuming Congress can shrink the Supreme Court's original jurisdiction. It cannot. And 9. Overusing the political question doctrine when the real question is whether a branch exceeded its powers. Time for the quick check, and this one comes straight from the Bargo Question Bank. Congress enacts an appropriation statute granting $50 million from the federal treasury directly to a network of religious academies, expressly to fund daily worship instruction. Priya is a federal taxpayer whose only connection to the program is that she pays federal income tax. She sues to enjoin the disbursement under the Establishment Clause. Does Priya have standing? Option 1. No, because a taxpayer's interest in federal spending is too remote. Option 2. Yes, because she challenges a congressional appropriation as violating the Establishment Clause. Option 3. Yes, because every taxpayer has a stake in the lawfulness of all federal spending. Pause here if you want a moment. The answer is option 2. The general rule denies taxpayers standing. The narrow exception applies when the plaintiff attacks an actual congressional appropriation and claims it violates a specific constitutional limit on the spending power. PREA does both, and the Establishment Clause is that limit. Option 1 states the ordinary rule and ignores the exception. Option 3 would abolish the rule altogether. If you had to stop and rebuild those two prongs, that is the one to drill. There are 30-plus more questions on this topic alone, each with every option explained like that. 5 things to take away. 1. Standing is 3 elements: injury in fact, causation, redressability, and the plaintiff needs them, not the issue. 2. A statutory right to sue is not a concrete injury, and you cannot sue to make the government enforce the law against someone else. 3. Rightness and mootness both demand a live controversy when the court rules. 4. A private party cannot sue a state for damages, in federal or state court. But Ex parte Young lets you enjoin an officer prospectively for a federal law violation, never a state law one. 5. Congress may limit the lower courts and carve at the appellate docket, and may never touch original jurisdiction. Which brings us back to Dana, holding a statute that promised her $500 and a courthouse door that never opened. The law was on her side. Article 3 was not. Next time, legislative powers. Practice this topic with more than 2,900 exam-style questions, free to start, at nextgenbargo.com. This episode is for education and exam preparation only, not legal advice, and we are not affiliated with or endorsed by the NCBE or any bar examining authority.